Hey, everybody, welcome to Big Blend Radio's Toast to the Art Show, where every third Saturday we get to talk with artist Victoria Chick. Victoria is a contemporary figurative artist and an early 19th and 20th century print collector. She's based out in Silver City, New Mexico, which is a beautiful art community in the southwest corner of the Land of Enchantment. And not only is she an artist out there, but she is a spearhead of the development of the Southwest Regional Museum of Art and Art Center. You can check that out if you go to swrm-art.org. But welcome back to the show, Victoria. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Lisa. I'm so glad to be here, be able to talk with you tonight about
You know
one of
what?
my favorite topics.
The art is always a topic, right? But today it's
Yes.
interesting because we're talking about illustrations in classic children's books. And I love this because September is actually National Library Card Sign-Up Month, like getting kids in there. It's also been throughout the month, there's all kinds of book-related events like International Literacy Day, a lot of book-related events in September. And I think it's also spurred because it's, back to school month and things like that. But I think, I grew up going to libraries. Did you do that too as a kid? Go to libraries for your books? I
Well,
did.
yeah, we had a bookmobile. I lived in the country, so having the bookmobile come during the
Oh.
summertime was like this magic thing. And you got to go in and you got to pick out as many books as you wanted. And I would always read mine probably within 3 days, and then have to wait another week for the bookmobile to show up again and turn these in and get new ones. So yeah, I was a reader, and I was a reader probably because my parents read to me when I was before I was able to read, and so I grew to love books. And at the time, I could see the pictures. They were wonderful books, and I was two and 3 years old, and my parents would read, turn the pages. I started to recognize words. Not that I could actually read them, but when my parents would turn the page, I knew immediately what that first word on the next page was going to be. So
Wow.
by the time I got to first grade, we didn't have kindergarten where I lived. By the time I got to first grade, I could read pretty well, and I fortunately the Dick and Jane books were pretty boring. After reading some after having my parents read these classical children's stories to me,
Well,
though there's
I just find it amazing that you have this mobile book like library back in the day, right? Of your
oh yeah.
childhood. And here, as a kid, I was, I was raised in Kenya, England, South Africa, and England. I'm trying to think back, but we also toured England, so we traveled a lot. But in Kenya, and my memory's a little, I always had books because Nancy always had books,
Yes,
You're
yes.
always reading. Reading was part of your daily life, read, read, read.
Right.
And we're also living on Karen Blixen's land, which is, everybody out of Africa, ladies' land, it's where we
Right,
lived.
right.
So like, we had a little, of that upbringing, a very colonial lifestyle there. Not that we were part of that community of, colonialism, but libraries were there and things like that was from that. We had that. South Africa, definitely. I was probably like 9, 10, 8, 9, 10 years old when we got there. I was living at the library and I read things like War and Peace, and I don't know, Nancy got me stuck, and we were talking about this the other day. MMK, the Far Pavilions and stuff. They like all these historical novels became part of my life, and I lived like I couldn't wait to come home from school to get back to my books. And I read books like insanely. And when they had illustrations, it was really cool. So this was a little bit older than what we're going to talk about, But even then, and I didn't know what I was reading about half the time. I mean, they were talking about sexual things that I didn't know. Like, I'm like, what? Mom, what's this? And she's like, not yet. I'll tell you a little bit, but like, not yet for the whole thing. Like, what you think now is enough, you know?
Right.
But what we're talking about is more the childhood things. And I remember Watership Down. Do you remember that? Did you get that book?
Yes.
What?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, now isn't that weird? That's I know we're going to talk about Beatrix Potter and Alice in Wonderland, but Watership Down. What do you think about that? And can, don't you think that was a little dark? Like in
It wasn't my favorite. I loved Wind in the Willows, and that was older
That's
probably.
my. That's right. That is my
And
England
then
time. Yeah, that I did have all that in England. So yeah.
yeah.
Oh, wow. Wind in
So
the Willows, that's true. But Watership Down go. Why is that? Okay. So we're going to talk about illustrations with these classical, you know, children's books, these classic ones. But the authors, we do so many interviews with children's book authors. And basically, they say the book is not going to happen without the illustrations and the illustrator. And they have to have a good relationship. And that's
Yes.
interesting going with your article and everyone that's on blendradioandtv.com, Victoria's article, and that's linked in the show notes. But that relationship, I can we just go right and move forward from the article where you talk about Lewis Carroll and his
Right.
illustrator, because that was an interesting relationship.
Well, it was, and they did not know each other. Before they were put together more or less. Sir John Daniel, he was really a sort of more like a editorial cartoonist. He worked for Punch magazine, which your readers may or may not know about Punch, but it was a real famous British magazine. It was in some ways very satirical and in some ways very timely with what they had to say about what was going on politically. So he was well known as an illustrator and a cartoonist for Punch for years before he met Lewis Carroll. But what he did, Carroll was trying to persuade him to be the illustrator for his books, and he wound up doing a lot of illustrations, 92, I think, for Alice in Wonderland, and they did more for Through the Looking Glass, and he was doing wood engravings, which
Wow.
was really hard. I mean, it's so exacting, because it's very hard wood, so it holds up during the printing process, and when the press is crunching it down, and that worked for a while, but then the technology changed. And so he started doing taking those wood engravings, and they were trying to make electroplate engravings out of it, which would be a mechanical kind of thing. And he hated those. The first ones, they printed a bunch of books, and he rejected all the books. I don't know, maybe I don't know if they got rid of them or burned them or whatever, but if they're still around, they're probably collector's items
Yeah.
now. So, but anyway, he wound up, they did another run on them, and he approved those. And what his illustrations were really, I think, what made that book so popular. If anybody who sees them, they're just so imaginative. They're so lively, and you can, they pick out the characters of the characters in the book so well. He wound up his reputation wound up. I mean, he'd been this illustrator for Punch for years and for other things, but really people remember him most for his illustrations for Lewis Carroll's books.
But it's interesting because you say in your article that like basically once he did these, you've got to think about it where, I just did an interview with a children's book author, and they animated his book into a video with animation, right? So you can read the book, have the hardcover book with your kid, and or here's the video part. And I was like, wow, this is cool, because everybody takes things in differently, right? And I was like, well, let's talk about the illustrator and how does this relationship work? And then I'm reading your article and thinking about these classics and how much time, like for his book to have been made through the editor, through the the one illustrator, then the animation people have to get all of it, put the sound, the voiceover, all of this. It was almost 2 years. And the
And
big publishers don't do anything with this. These are all independents, because the big publisher, the big five, it's like our big five music labels, right? Don't do vinyl, where the rest, the independents, are saying, hey, you're missing out, buddies, and you're making it more costly because you're not dipping in your funds. You're anyway. But there's the same thing in the publishing world right now. This kind of craft has gone out the window. They've left that. And the independents are standing up and going, hey, we want animation. We're doing this, but they have to have this. Like he had in his book, it was about a multi-ethnic, it's called Fried Rice and Marinara, because it was about a kid that is Italian and Chinese. And there's no books that represent
Cultural,
background, multicultural ethnicity, and for kids to understand. And so that's what the book is about. And he's going, holy cow, I didn't know what but he's a broadcaster. He works, for the NFL broadcasting station and stuff. Mike Yam is his name. And he was, I mean, it was amazing to hear the what he went through to get this done. And to see the illustrations, because I look at every children's book that we interview the authors about, and I'm like, the illustrations, if you didn't have the illustrator, your story is not told at all. You know what I mean?
A lot of times the publisher, the editor will connect, will know enough illustrators that they will try to connect what they consider to be a suitable illustrator for the type of book or the storyline to the author. And sometimes that works really well, but it's always a chance that when somebody else is trying to be a matchmaker, that the match isn't perfect. And there's always with what you're talking about with all the video and stuff. I mean, the author has the chance there, or there's a built-in chance, I guess, for him to lose total control and start to feel that it's not his book anymore. So I think it's tricky. It's very tricky.
It's very tricky in children's books. I just want to say, is like people think, oh, I'm just going to throw out a children's book as part of my branding and marketing thing, right? My like web of clothesline kind of thing. Children's books, for them to work, you actually need to understand children's minds. You have to be able to rhyme the right way for that right age group. You have to, or not rhyme, depending. Like Mike Yam, he definitely could do it, and it worked. It worked really well, and he understands. He's a broadcaster. He's a, he's a newsman. He understands how to sell a story. But, and he had the illustrator called him and said, and she's in a different country. She's like, to represent Chinese and Italian, you need to send me photos of your family, so I can do it right. And she did. It's amazing what she did. I mean, it's
That's good.
actually quite mind-blowing when you think what we can do now. But I'm going back to Beatrix Potter, who we're going to talk about, and then Lewis Carroll's with his illustrator John Tenniel. I mean, this was woodblocking. Like, this is like a whole industrial. Like, I want to say this is industrious versus what we do with a click of a mouse, and both are hard work. Both are hard work.
Yes.
So, yeah, this is a little interesting about how it was, and he
Well,
basically didn't want to do it anymore, like it seems like.
yeah, there are different schools of thought, because he was asked by Lewis Carroll, who was very thrilled with his illustrations. He was asked to illustrate additional books, and he just flat out refused. And people thought, well, maybe he was just burned out, because it was really hard work. They thought maybe he just put so much energy into it that he just didn't want to do it again. I don't know why, why he didn't, because but he went back to illustrating doing cartoons for Punch, and he did that for many more years. And he wound up that the interesting thing, I think, with him, I mean, he was an illustrator for a long time. His reputation appeared to be more, he was more successful for those two books he illustrated for Lewis Carroll than he was for all the work he did for Punch. And I read that he did over 2,300 cartoons for Punch, and
Wow.
people like them, but they don't, they're on the paper, they're in the Punch magazine, and then they're gone. And
Oh.
whereas the book is a classic, and it's lasted. I mean, gosh, it's been since the 1860 something
Yeah.
that book was first published. So it's lasted. It's created
I wonder
his
if it's because someone
reputation.
told him what to do. And that's the thing. Like, that's what I was talking about. Like, hey, these artists now are used to, like, okay, tell me your vision and we're going to create this. Like, it's like creating a website. Tell me your vision, we'll create this, right? And it's kind of that same thing. Whereas back then, this was part of communication, if you think about it. What he was doing, Sir John Tenniel was. Cartoons and all of that was part of the communication of what was going on. So I wonder if that was his cozy spot. This pushed him into a out of his comfort zone, and he got pissy with it because people told him what to do. And at the same time, he had he only had one eye for eyesight. And so don't tax my eye over your opinions. I can understand getting pissy with that. Just being in the industry of it all. I get it. Nancy's
Plus,
giving a nod of that too.
he was dedicated. He agreed to do it, and he was dedicated. And so he carried on through the, doing all these illustrations. And if he, and even just for one book, or two books, I guess, 92 wood engravings is a tremendous undertaking.
That's
And
huge.
he just yeah. So he just might have been tired of it, of the technique, I think he got along okay with Lewis Carroll.
Can you tell everyone that may not understand? I mean, I know people listening are interested in art and understand, but some may not know the extent of the work of being an engraver. Can you just explain that process of what he does to get one piece of
Sure,
art?
sure, sure. Engraving got started back in medieval times, and maybe a little bit before that, when people had swords and armor made, and they would put designs on them, and then to show the client that they were making, they would rub a little ink on the design they'd made on the armor. And they would put a piece of paper on it and pat it down, and so pull it off, so they would have a sort of picture of what the design was on the metal. So they would peel it off, and the ink would stick. So that was how engraving really started, and that was pretty primitive. But then in the 17th century and the 16th century, it got people started actually being engravers. They usually fell to jewelers to do this. And then later on, by the 17th century, engraving had gotten very complicated. They would engrave an artist. Okay, let's talk about, we can use Albrecht Dürer as an example. Albrecht Dürer did these wonderful designs. He engraved some his stuff. He engraved them on metal plates, these pictures that he did. But then later in the next century, other people would come along. I want a copy of that. Well, Albrecht Dürer was now dead and couldn't do anymore. And so they would have other engravers that were very skilled, and they would copy these engravings. And they were only using metal at that time. Then they started using wood, a very hard-grained, fine-grained wood. And they were using slightly different tools, but the lines were very thin, and it required just as much skill to dig through the wood slightly. And the thing with wood is, it didn't stand up a long time, depending on how much pressure was given by the press. So there was a limit to the number of prints they could make. Maybe they could do a couple thousand, So the runs of these editions were small, and
Wow.
before they'd
So when
have to
it
do
gets,
another,
how does it get into a book? Like from that to a book and then
Well,
being reproduced in a
they would
book.
it's just like a page in a book. So they would do these things as pages, and then the pages would be sewn into the book, just like the print was sewed in.
Because what
So
I saw was some of the pages, like the Queen of Hearts was in there with the writing around the actual illustration. So that's kind of a, like back then, that had to be like a huge deal to make that happen. And I know just even Nancy and I, like Nancy, even when she started her magazine in South Africa, it was cut and paste. I mean, serious, real deal. And like it wasn't, we didn't have all these little grid things that we can use now in our stuff. And even that now it's changing now. It's like intuitive design, which is a pain in the ass. Sorry. Oopsie. But it's
Well,
true. It's not the same.
book
I
binding,
mean, it's weird. It's weirdly different now.
Well, it is. It is. And now a lot of books are just simply glued together. They don't sew them in like they used to.
Right.
So, a lot of times, you buy a book and you read it a few times, and then the cover pops off
Yeah, no kidding.
because
Welcome to Walmart.
the glue is
Oopsie,
given
sorry, I
out.
didn't say that. Yeah, I didn't say that. But yeah, I didn't say that. I did not say that. But no, but that's the truth.
But back then,
Yeah.
back in the 19th century, the 18th century, book binding was considered one of the arts, and there was a lot of care that went into it. And they would, besides what you expect a book to have, like the copy and pictures, there were also all these extra special pages in the front and the back that were beautifully
Color.
inked, with the color pages that was, it was sort of filler, but it made the book beautiful.
God, you're making me feel ancient, even just in our own magazine. I mean, you've known us since our print days, and we had print magazine, and I remember like you could have like the 8 pages of color in printing, right? And then we were like, no, we want, I mean, at first we had to. And so like, these are the pages that were color. And like, you could sell ads that were in color on these pages. And basically you're paying for the whole magazine if you're doing that, because it's so much money, And then we went full color through. I mean, it was like, oh, you're doing this many. And then you had to know the layout by 8, by this grid of 8. And now, you're digital, and it's like, oh yeah, we can do anything. I mean, even if you did a bleed or not, like if your picture went to the edges was a big deal for
Yes.
printing. I mean, and
Right.
now I'm thinking going back to this book, and think of Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, and I think like he did a lot of pen and ink look like to me, like even the one where she's holding the flamingo. I'm sorry, I love the flamingo thing. So,
Well,
I'm going.
what Tennille did the designs. By the time he and I think he started to do the engraving, but by the time it became so popular, there was no way that they could continue to do it that way. So they got a professional. They had a professional engraver to carry on, and so
Oh.
he wasn't because they were switching. They switched from the original. And wood engraving to the photo engraving. So the technology started changing so much. So he was not he quit being involved, because it was now out of his hands, really. So
Wow.
yeah. So
That's wild. Like, I mean, yeah, and then you have to let go of your own art,
yeah.
Yeah,
But
well, I mean, oh.
people who do commercial stuff, they understand that, and they don't get bent out of shape about it. It's not because they know there's going to be a
Yeah,
lot
it's
of
commercial.
copies, and their name is still on it, still connected with it. They still get credit for it.
But I think
And
with him and Punch was a big deal. It's like being Mad
oh yeah,
Magazine or Rolling Stone, or
yes,
like that was
right.
the sign of the times. Like Rolling Stone is actually, I think, right now, probably doing some more of the crazier stuff. And Mad Magazine's, no, I miss that. I just like the animation
Yeah,
and the cartoons.
I haven't seen it in so long,
No, I don't think it exists anymore. I really don't.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate anything that has those visuals and,
Right.
I love comics,
Yeah.
because there's also a dryness of it. Like there's this
Right.
sarcasm and the dryness of that comedy. But I really appreciate what he did as an artist, because you look through it, it's like, and then you think he's using one eye to do all of this.
Yeah.
So he's really straining and using everything he has to do this. I think
Right.
that is amazing. But that amount of work, I wanted people to understand that, like how much went into these
Yeah.
books
And
at
if
that time,
it could be, because his eye disease was, or his eye was a progressive loss. So it could be that he just was, his vision was not up to par for him to do that kind of work anymore. So,
Or he just really wanted to
anything I've
focus
run
on
on
his
him.
thing, He, I
Yeah.
don't know. I just kind of feel like when you're in that newsy industry, like you kind of, there is an excitement with it.
Yeah.
I can't explain it other than you have an
No,
excitement of the
there is.
pulse.
Yeah. Every time an edition comes out, it's a thrill.
A book is a task. It's this heavy load. And then once you do it, it's like, okay. And then like now, like all the authors we interview, okay, I've done this book, I'm done. But now, no, you have to go and do all these, press
But
things, and they're like, we're done. We're done with it. I'm done with it. I want to move on.
your public is never satisfied, because they will really love your book, and they'll say, what's your next book going to be? But now the pressure's on again. But anyway,
Yeah,
I
and
think
most of them
now,
actually have it. But I want to go to, oh, I can't wait, Beatrix Potter. Nancy took
yes,
me
I.
to Beatrix Potter's place as a kid. That was when we
Oh
lived in
yeah.
England. This
Yeah.
was a special, I think it was still winter in the Lake District, and we did go to the Lake District in England when we lived there. And I mean, it's kind of interesting when I do think about, like, I always went to the historical novels when we first started talking, and then I realized, like, yeah, I've read this, done that, yeah, yep, no. But Beatrix Potter, I think, we talked about it on the last show you were on with the Jefferson Highway, and I got into Carolyn Dorman and all the the botanical drawings and stuff, which it really, I'm still, I got stuck down the rabbit hole of Beatrix Potter again and all the mushrooms because I just was in mushroom land in the Appalachians. And I just, I honestly want to say that I think this is probably one of the most important forms of communicating science and nature to people versus photography, actually, in a weird way. I'm not dissing photography, but I just feel like there's this other, like, this is important that people shouldn't forget this art form.
Well, an interesting thing to me about, well, first of all, let's compare and contrast Tennille. Tennille was illustrating for someone else. Beatrix Potter sort of started out that way,
And then she
doing
said, "Screw you all."
illustrations from the mushrooms and all kinds of botanical stuff, and she was very skilled. She was in demand by the scientific community at the time to do these illustrations because she could was so exact. But she gained that exactness throughout her life. She never went to art school or anything. She just was a very observant person and was able to record what she saw, and that's really important. But she was also had this fabulous imagination, and she lived on always lived on a farm or out in the country. She had a brother. They never went to school. They were tutored by their mother, and who must have been an intelligent person. They always had pets. They were surrounded by farm animals, so she was observant, and she when she started illustrating, writing stories, and illustrating her stories with by with animals using her observational skills. But she was more than just a recorder when she did these stories, because she was able to imbue personality into these illustrations. And so the characters, I think, are really lively. They are somewhat anthropomorphic because they talk and they do things that children can relate to. And I think she's a wonderful illustrator. Oh gosh, the other thing she did,
She's amazing.
which I think,
I think she, I mean, going there, having been to her, she's got a garden and all kinds of, as a kid, like, I just remember, like, I know it was winter, so it was very bleakish, you know, even though we were in the Lake District, it was that bleak kind of look, but there were hidden things everywhere. That is my immediate memory, is hidden things like bunnies and hidden stuff around. I mean, I don't know. I have to, you know, Glenn and North, our Norfolk Tours guy will have to tell me like where I'm missing or whatever. But I just remember as a kid, there was something hidden to look at and to make you look. I think it
Well,
did something for me.
when you went there, that was that, you got to see where she lived. You got you she had given all that property. She wound up being a really wealthy woman. She was smart. She was a great artist, I think. She was a good
I agree.
storyteller, and she had a financial mind. And so she got a little bit of a will. In a will, she gained some property for some money from her aunt. She bought more property. She would buy, she kept her books were selling very well. This would be about the early 20th century, like 1901, 1920, in that era. And her books were doing well. She started buying more property. Well, when she finally died, she gave her property to the country, and to be turned in and it was turned into a national park, that whole area that she at one time owned. And I'm sure that what one of the things she did that was so astute, she was the first person, probably, and the first person I've ever heard of who understood marketing. She was a precursor to Disney Corporation, you know, because she made actual toys, had actual toys made and marketed based on the illustrations and the
See,
characters in her books. So
she understood, like Ted DeGrazia, which we've talked about on the shows before, but in Tucson, he had that mindset too. He was like, all right, you want this? Here's where this part of my art is, and then here's this commercial side that you guys want. You want it? Here, I'm going to give it to you because I can. And then other artists poo-poo it, but they're like, hello, I'm paying my bills, doing what I love and understanding what the public wants, but I'm still doing what I really want. And I think that's actually kind of an interesting model. It is a business model, right? I mean, because she still did exactly what she wanted. And so did Ted DeGrazia. Like she did what she wanted. Like she did. She did.
So anyway,
I love that.
I admire her. I think she
I
was
do.
ahead of her time.
I just love that she did the fungi thing because that's all I've been in. My mind is I've been in like fungi land in my head. Like I would like
Oh
to
my
draw
gosh.
them more than photograph them because I have a dog pulling me, like, when I was in this forest. I just wish I could just draw them because I would be more exact than the photography in a way. I understand we can do everything exact in photography, but there are faces that come out in the fungus. Like I can't explain it. It's weird. I'm weird, but Beatrix Potter. Yeah, I mean, she's a huge part of my childhood, and I thank Nancy for that and taking me to her place. And I think for her as an artist too, got to see that. It's like, how do you
It's
tell that
amazing.
story? Isn't that?
It's amazing.
It is.
It's amazing to me what we remember as children that is important to us. And you know, our parents take us places and they think this will be nice for them, you know, to see this. But they don't realize the impact lifelong that certain things have.
Right. Well,
And
Nancy told me that she told me that when I was a kid and before we went to Africa and England and everything, when we were first here in the States, she took me to Disneyland. That was a thing. And she was all excited. I'm taking you to Disneyland. And Nancy worked there at one point, She learned how to cut silhouettes and do all that stuff there. And she took me to Disneyland and we came home and she's like, oh, did you have fun? I said, yeah, I saw a lot of knees because I'm in a stroller and that's all I saw, And so that's a perspective, right? And so it's a very interesting thing. Yeah. And here she's like, I'm taking my child to Disneyland. I'm doing this, doing that. And she wants the best. But Beatrix Potter had hidden things. Like, I'm going to say, like, I've never had a thing about going to Disneyland my whole life, and people look at me like I'm stupid. I really don't care. And I think he's amazing what he's done, Walt Disney. But Beatrix Potter had hidden things to look at. And it just, even as we're, it just dawned on me as we were talking on the show, like she had hidden things to look for. And that is everything to kids. They want to look for things. And in a book, I think you want that. You want, I think that's why, like, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and stuff worked because there was like hidden things, the clues, and mystery books are such a big deal as no matter what age you're at, right?
Well,
You want to be
I think,
part of it.
you're right. And when you read a book, you imagine what people look like or what situations are, when they're describing a scene, you are recreating it in your mind based on what they say in the book. But then if they turn it into a movie or they turn it into a TV show or something, frequently it's disappointing, no matter how good it is, because the people that are cast may not meet your expectations. And so you have to change. It's just not the same thing. And you have to, if you want to like it, you have to make an adjustment. But
Yeah, I just I'm just thinking of Beatrix Potter and that property, man. I remember it now. Like it, like the more we talk, the more I see it, or maybe my mind's just recreating it, you know what I mean? But it's kind of a trip to think about. Because I don't even think she was even that old. I don't even think the whole place was open when we were there. I don't think it was, or something. Like it was kind of like a close season, but here you are, you're lucky to
Well, you
be
know,
there moment.
by the time she gave it, I'm sure she had, I'm sure it was over 500 acres, maybe larger. So probably a lot of it was just left natural.
And hey, we got to give a shout out to America because we started the National Park Service, and the Lake District is a national park unit of England. So just saying, we did it first. just saying, we get to do that once in a while, you know. But Victoria, what a cool thing. I mean, it's really cool because in a way, when we think about what kids read, the illustrations may tune them into art, right? I mean, I'm still looking at Alice holding onto a flamingo going, what the heck? You know, I gotta look into that. I'm gonna read more. I'm gonna get involved more. And opens our minds. That's the thing too. It's about opening our minds. And the relationship between words and art, that is huge. Now, we're looking at illustrations being words, art, animation, music, vocals, you know? It's changed. I mean, it really has. Everybody, keep up with Victoria. Go to victoriachick.com. She is here every third Saturday. We love it. I mean, you know, it never ends with what we talk about. Every time she comes on the show, I'm like, go down a rabbit hole, literally with Beatrix Potter, right? So victoriachick.com and bigblendradio.com. Thank you for joining us, listeners. Thank you, Victoria.
You're more than welcome. We'll talk to you next month.